All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Hey everyone, Tom Salami here. Welcome to Device Talks Weekly. It's a very special Wednesday episode for you. Something to listen to if you're driving to the families or flying to the families or going somewhere for Thanksgiving. Or if you're just living your normal life and you don't celebrate American Thanksgiving, then enjoy this podcast, however you typically do. And it's going to be an easy one to enjoy. These are two great interviews that I did at Device Talks West. We'll open with our FOMO interview with Aman Jetty. She's Senior Vice President and General Manager of DaVinci Platforms and Product Operations at Intuitive. And Aman Jetty and I closed out Device Talks West and our Jason Robo business event with a presentation slash conversation on the big stage at the event at the Santa Clara Convention Center. I left out the presentation part. It was fantastic. Aman Jetty did a great job. I had the opportunity to sit down with her and talk to her for about 15 minutes afterwards, and we'll run that portion. And then later on, after my conversation with Aman, we will have my talk with Anne Ostois. She, of course, is the CEO of Moon Surgical and was kind enough to join us on the end of day one. So both of these closed out our days. Anne was the final keynote of day one for Device Talks West. And we talked about her path into medtech and Moon Surgical's approach to providing a new type of surgical robot. Or is it a surgical robot? That's the question. We covered that grand controversy as well. But Anne was terrific to talk to, and very happy to bring you this conversation with both of these leaders in surgical robotics. Before we begin this episode, though, I want to take a moment to give my great thanks to our sponsor, Murata, for making this episode possible. Murata provides you with reliable components to design life-changing healthcare solutions. You can find out more at its website. Murata is spelled Murata. And again, the website is murata.com. We'll also have a brochure that you can download in our show notes if you'd like more information about Murata. So thanks again to Murata for making this episode of Device Talks Weekly possible. Now we'll kick things off again with the conversation that I had with Aman Jetty of Intuitive Surgical. Let's listen. So you initially started out in the medical device industry and then moved over to Intuitive.
That's right.
What are the similarities, what are the differences between working on a medical device that's simply that and a medical device that's also a robot?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been at Intuitive for close to 13 years now, coming up on 13 years. Prior to that, I was at Abbott Diabetes Care for close to 6 years. I was an engineer on their continuous glucose monitoring system, worked to bring that system to first commercial release. It was a Freestyle Navigator, now evolved to Freestyle Libre. Before that, I worked at a various different startups, capital, imaging, magnetoencephalography, heart valves, catheters, a bunch of things. So not a roboticist by training, and joined Intuitive in 2013. I would say there are more similarities than there are differences.
Interesting.
Yeah, if you think about trying to solve it's not just about trying to solve a mechanical problem or a software problem or a technology problem. It's really the similarity of the anchor is trying to solve a clinical problem. And I think that makes the two industries very similar. I would also say highly, highly regulated. And so the fundamentals of developing product in a highly regulated environment is very common between the two.
So you haven't worked at a robotics company, a non-medical robotics company, but what do you think are the challenges that are unique to designing a surgical robot?
It's not a single product. We talk about the robot, but it's just so much more than just a robot. If you think of medical device industry, most people do capital equipment, or they do single use, or they do disposables. When you work for a robotics company, it's everything. It's the capital system, it's the single use, it's the multi-use, it's the imaging, it's the all the different end effectors, it's the accessories, the digital, the software. So the complexity is much higher than I've ever experienced before. I would also say, maybe similar to the capital imaging industry, working on capital system has some unique challenges. These systems stay in the field for a really long time. So you can imagine, a Da Vinci has over 10,000 parts in the robot. And you can imagine servicing these parts, maintaining these over the lifetime in a way that maintains reliability and safety is quite a challenge. You can think about all the supply challenges that you might have over the lifetime of the product. It's similar, I would say, to the capital imaging, with the nuance that maybe there are more moving components in a robotic system, so that adds more nuance and challenge to it.
It's a really amazing piece of equipment. How has motion scaling, haptics, and force feedback evolved? You talked a bit about that in the presentation in recent generations of Intuitive's platform.
I would say that some of these capabilities have been part of the original design since day one. If you think about motion scaling and tremor and vibration reduction, the early designs all included these capabilities. Over successive generations, we have improved both on the hardware as well as the algorithms to make these better. But if you think about the core sort of value proposition in robotic surgery, it's taking this large scale movement of the surgeon's hand and refining that to much finer movements and much finer scale. And so that premise has continued to endure. Over time, we have, obviously improved them. On force feedback and haptics has been something that has, been an aspirational feature for a few decades now, and I think has been in the works and in development for a few decades. There are, the fundamentals of being able to feel the tissue, that was taken away. When surgeons went even from open to lap, they lost that capability. And so they had to retrain themselves to rely on visual cues and tissue effect to be able to sort of estimate how much force they were putting on tissue. So this capability has been something that's been aspirational. I think if you think about the challenges of putting really small, scalable sensors at the tip of the instruments, that has been the challenge. I think the thought is that no force feedback data is better than bad force feedback data. So there are possibilities of making these measurements in a different part of the system. Like you can make force measurements at the arm of the robot or at the cannula, it's the metal tube where instruments go through. And you can make force measurements, but they wouldn't be accurate. And so I think, at Intuitive, we really waited for this technology to mature at a point where you're making the measurement directly at the tip of the instrument. So if you think about the size of the sensor, but also the reliability of that sensor that needs to be there to endure cleaning, sterilization, and also the economic feasibility, right, to make it work, that has been sort of what's been the most challenging.
How do you design for surgeons? I mean, soft tissue surgery as opposed to maybe hard tissue is a lot more artistry and sort of finesse than.
Yeah.
How do you build a technology that performs those highly dexterous movements?
So I think it really goes back to what is the clinical problem you're trying to solve, right? And so if you think about if you think about that problem and you say, well, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to make some clinical tasks be easier than lap. What is the hardest clinical task that you can do in lap? It's suturing, right? So what is the capability of the system that you need to design to do lap better? I think that's the problem you're trying to solve. And so if you think about, you know, this is a challenge where you introduce mechatronics and then you introduce software on top of that to make the system perform in ways that you want it to perform. And then you make a clinical evaluation. Is this better than what's already out there? Is this better than lap? And would people want to use it? And if the answer is yes, then you're there. So there's a clinical evaluation that may be subjective, but really that bar is it better than lap?
But surgeon skill levels are of varying degrees. Do you design for those with the lowest degrees? Do you design for those with the highest? How do you take all those difference and those inabilities into account?
We design to make the system as intuitive as possible so that, you know, that's
right.
There it
is. That's the name.
It's hard not to bring it up in the conversation. But really, it's designed to be able to reduce that training burden as much as possible.
And when you're bringing in new advances, new adjustments, new capabilities to the systems, how do you know when a breakthrough, an addition, is mature enough to commercialize, given the regulatory and reliability concerns?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, we have a framework and a process that we use to evaluate new technology. And, you know, as we look at these technologies, we really evaluate first and foremost what customers want it, right? Is it desirable from the customer perspective? Would they want to pay for it economically? And then we look at feasibility, like technical feasibility. Do you have the technology to make this possible? And it goes back to the force feedback example. Do you have the sensors that you can implement at scale economically to make this a viable sort of product? And so we look at that holistically to make that evaluation.
And you talked a bit about data and the importance of that, and now we're of course seeing AI being incorporated into systems. What's the most promising ways AI is being used in your system today? Not for the clinical decision making, not as much for sort of control or calibration or safety.
If you don't think about for clinical, you know, we gather a lot of data from our systems. And one of the ways that we use this data is we look at ways for implementing preventative maintenance processes. So in most cases, we would be able to know when an issue might occur even before the issue occurred. And this is part of the reason why we have the uptime that we have, and is that we can service these systems using the data that we have that are coming from them, and be able to predict their performance.
Let's talk about the Da Vinci SP. What are surgeons finding the strongest use cases for Da Vinci SP? Maybe give us a little more background on SP.
Yeah.
And where are the innovations occurring using the SP?
So, as you know, Da Vinci SP, you know, architected for single incision and narrow access surgery, the value hypothesis around SP, it has really been around, you know, maybe single incision is better than multiple incisions. One incision is going to be better than four from an outcomes perspective. I think as we've seen usage of this technology in the field, we've come to realize that there's more to the story than just reducing the number of incisions. So as an example, surgeons have been able to use this technology to innovate in the surgical approach. So I'll give a couple of examples. One, you know, prostate surgery is a very common type of procedure that has full adoption on our multi-port system. The traditional approach for this surgery is that, there's an entry point into the abdomen. There's a sac called the peritoneum, which holds all the abdominal organs. And so when you enter, you have to enter into this peritoneum to access the prostate. And when you do, there's complications, right? So you are in a space where other organs exist. You are, making sort of manipulations in the space. you're exposing to CO2 and to air. So there's a lot of complications. Now with SP, surgeons have innovated on the technology. They figured out, because they can do narrow access and deep pelvic access, to go around the peritoneum. So these new approaches like extraperitoneal, prostate, retroperitoneal, kidney have been developed, and they all show much improvement in terms of the outcomes, lower pain, faster, you know, same day releases, you know, from the hospital. So that's really one example. Another example that's very recent, because we just recently had this indication approved in the U.S. This is a for thoracic surgery, so for lung cancer. In the traditional approach, both, you know, VATS or multi-port, the ports are placed in between the ribs, so intercostal port placements. And the ribs, in between the ribs, these are places where you've got a high density of nerves, you've got a high density of vessels, and so it not only increases risk, it increases postoperative pain, and just, you know, lots of complications that go along with it. Because of the pain of having to breathe, patients don't breathe as deeply, and so they develop postoperative pneumonia, all these types of... So with SP, again, because of the ability to go deep and go narrow, surgeons are placing the port in subcostal or subxiphoid, you know, but underneath the ribs and underneath the xiphoid, drilling up through the chest and basically accessing the lungs through there. And so you can imagine it's not an intercostal space, it's single incision. Patients, you know, lots of improved outcomes. Hopefully we'll see based on the studies that are yet to come.
Cool. Last couple of questions is looking ahead. How close are we to meaningful semi-autonomous functions in surgical robotics?
Yeah, it's auto-suturing, right? What I would say is, if you take a very outcomes, sort of first principles outcomes-based view, yes, you know, auto-suturing presents some opportunities to bring efficiency, to maybe bring consistency to the suturing process, maybe reduce the operative time. Maybe, though, it's not maybe the first place I would go to if you think about what are the things that you could do to improve outcomes. So, you know, I'll give an example. I talked about advanced imaging. So, again, I'll go back to the prostate example. In prostate surgery, you're removing the prostate gland, which, you know, has cancer in it. Cancer is not visible with the naked eye. So you're removing the prostate, and then... you know, you're taking a few samples to see if there's a positive margin. And there is a high percentage of patients who undergo prostate surgery and their cancer comes back. So, but what if you could add the capability of being able to visualize cancer in real time so that surgeons could make, you know, decisions in real time? So those are the type of, I think, conversations that we have, like where are the high impact value drivers to improve outcome and help towards, you know, moving us in the quintuple aim. Auto suturing possible, maybe not the top of the list.
Final question, just zooming out a bit. How do you look at the evolving surgical robotic market, the number of other companies out there? How does that affect your roadmap for the future?
Yeah. There are indeed a lot of there's a lot of activity right now in the space, hundreds of robotic companies. I think from an intuitive perspective, our view is we're aware of them. We respect the work that they're doing. Lots of great work happening. You know, our philosophy has always been, you know, learn from everyone, copy no one, and so we continue to take a very first principles look at what are the capabilities that we want to bring to market. And, you know, we have spent a considerable amount of time evaluating different technologies. So if you sort of go back to what is core to surgery, right? What are the things that you need to do in surgery to be successful? There are a number of things that you need to do. One, you need to find access into the body. Get access, enter the body. Then you need to visualize the surgical field, so you need vision. then you need to get to where you need to go. You need to get to that destination. So reach, you know, access, you need to get there. Once you get there, you need to perform the clinical task that you need to do. And this is usually dissection, resection, you know, bleeding control, and then reconstruction, right? And then you need to extract the specimen and get out. That is like the basics of surgery. And so when you think about the different modalities, what you're really thinking about is, you know, are they better in access? Are they better in reach? Are they better in performing the clinical task? And we evaluate all those capabilities and decide on architectures based on those criteria. And so at the end of the day, it comes to architectural decisions and choices. So we will continue to be mission-focused in that sense.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that vision today. Appreciate you having you here at our joint meeting of Device Talks and Robo Business. Thanks, Manjeti. Okay, thanks again to Manjeti for joining us at Device Talks West. Now we'll continue this episode and continue the surgical robotics theme with my other keynote conversation with Anne Nosdois. Again, she is the CEO of Moon Surgical. Moon Surgical is the creator and producer of the Maestro robot, which is really gaining a foothold as a surgical assistant in laparoscopic surgery, finding its way into ASCs and other clinical settings. And once again, I'd like to thank Murata for making this episode possible. Murata provides you with reliable components to design life-changing healthcare solutions. Now, let's hear my conversation with Anne Nosdois, the CEO of Moon Surgical. So we always open up these conversations, as everyone knows, about the path into med tech. We've had you on the podcast before. I've listened to another recent podcast you were on. I love your story, how you wanted to be a doctor, but you didn't want to, as is typical in France, live with your parents for the entire time you were in med school. So you chose a different path. What was it about wanting to be a doctor that you found appealing? And I'd love to learn if medtech is sort of satisfying.
A good surrogate.
Yes, exactly.
First, thank you for the invitation, right?
My pleasure.
I've always wanted to be a doctor. Interestingly, I've tried to do that much later in my life.
Oh, really?
You know, including, about 10 years ago. I think there was nobody who was a doctor in my family. I mean, it was like completely this crazy idea, right? I just had a just genuine interest for, you know, basically, you know, treating or curing even patients and trying to bring some sort of contribution there. Just also very interested in how our bodies work, and you know, still very, very fascinated by that as of today, and how to try to live a healthy life. Although I'm maybe not the best example of
well,
that.
You're CEO of a startup. You've got a license. Yeah.
So I think it was just a natural interest and passion of mine. As you said, it didn't happen because I just couldn't see myself studying for all these years and staying with my parents, which is typically what you do if you live in Paris and you study in Paris. Mm-hmm. France is a very centralized country from that standpoint, and Paris is, you know, not a place where you would move out as a student. It's just too costly to do that. I was interested in everything, but I had more of a scientific background. Mm-hmm. My parents are both scientifically trained, and so sort of naturally went into biomedical engineering with that idea that there would still be opportunities to interact with clinicians, hopefully on a very frequent basis in my professional life, and that I would essentially spend, you know, a decent amount of time in hospitals, but under a different capacity. So that was the thinking, and it's been true to this date. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's really part of what I like, the most is just going in and seeing how clinicians and their staff work, seeing how your product is being used, seeing how they work without your product, being in first in human experiences. I've done that, you know, 4 times to date, and it's always a very intense moment. So yeah, I think it's been a great way to, you know, get into that environment differently.
I think it's ironic too that you've created basically a robotic version of what you might have been, in this case, a surgical assistant.
Never thought about it this way.
Yeah, look at that. So let's get into the story of Moon and Maestro. How was this idea first conceived? I mean, it's a different take on most surgical robotic systems that we've seen. And it's both, I think, very ambitious, but also very, that's the word I'm looking for, very, very precise in what it's trying to be. How did Moon come to be?
Yeah, so we, meaning Dave, myself, have nothing to do with it. all the credit goes to our surgeon founder, whose name is Professor Brice Gaillet. He's a French laparoscopy surgeon in his 70s. He was, you know, probably one of the first guys to adopt laparoscopy and help develop it in Europe. He had also been involved in the early days of Intuitive and sort of had moved away from that concept and branched into this idea that there must be a way to develop platforms that are a lot more collaborative and keep the surgeon at the bedside. And so that was his idea, and he had been collaborating with a robotics lab in Paris that had helped him source the right underlying technology to build that concept. And so it really meant identifying essentially an arm that would bring that surgical experience and that wouldn't impair the movements of the surgeon when they're at the bedside. So arms that would be able to follow them and support them and keep instruments stable, but really collaborate with the surgeon in a variety of different ways and switch between these different modes, okay? Which is obviously very different from what happens in a teleoperated system where you're giving instructions through input devices and these are being replicated or transmitted, right, at a distance in essentially always the same mode, right? So they had worked on identifying the kind of the underlying technology, and I had known the surgeon for, you know, the past 15 years, having worked with him on other projects. And at some point, someone told me, "Hey, you should check it out." Not even him, right? But someone told me, "Hey, he has something that might be ready for a transfer into a company, so you might want to have a look." And so I went there, and got a demo into the lab. It was interesting. That demo was very different from what we're doing today because the arms were holding the active instruments of the surgeon.
Just as an assistant would sort of
exactly, just as bracing, if you will. And the arms were being used to allow or restrict the movement of the surgeon into like no-flight zones and support their movements. Okay, and so, you know, looked at that and I was like, okay, that's interesting, Dries, but I think we should use that in a totally different way, because. This surgeon that founded the company, he's a hepatobiliary surgeon, and he also does very sophisticated esophageal surgery. So he's really about doing long and complex surgeries where, you do have a lot of clinical decision making, and part of that clinical decision making is about sparing, you know, parts of the anatomy. So his concept applied to that, but I didn't think it was a market that was large enough, right? So we sort of toyed with the concept, did a few workshops, brought some industry experts to look at this demo with us over the following few weeks, and then got to the point where, you know, we needed to research a question that was, hey, if we had a platform that held the two other instruments and supported and assisted the surgeon, would that be enough of a value proposition to turn it into a venture and invest in it and, you know, develop it?
So let's take a moment and just describe Maestro. And give some folks, you can Google it, obviously. You've got your phones, you can get a picture of it. But what is its function, and how does it work side by side with the surgeon?
Yeah, so the Maestro system is a collaborative surgical platform that essentially augments the surgeon and empowers them with two additional arms, which makes them able to control double the number of instruments, right? Four instruments versus two, and makes them a lot more autonomous, in control, and as a result of the things I said before, more efficient in the way they're delivering laparoscopy.
Interesting. Okay. So do you define Maestro as a surgical robot?
Mm-hmm.
You do.
No. I did
okay,
not,
next question.
Did not say anymore. No, it's a very controversial question.
It is,
so
I know.
I'm going to
invoke
my right to the Fifth Amendment. So technically it is a surgical robot, absolutely. But it's not what people picture as a surgical robot. Well, it's not what they expect when they think about a surgical robot, because it's very different from what has existed on the market.
Yeah, I mean, and forgive the use of this term, intuitive, but intuitively I would see this as being like...
Instinctively.
Instinctively, thank you. That's even better. That's a great name for a company. I would see this as sort of like the first generation of a surgical robot, in that it's kind of like having the robot work to next to someone at a factory or something. It's like providing a similar or a supporting function of them, as opposed to standing in between them and the car.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I love that there's a controversy about it, because controversies are fun. But how much of Moon's business model is the robot, and how much of it is what's your building around the robot?
So that's a great question. So we spend the first few years building the platform, right, which is hardware and software, and you know, taking that into the clinic, developing our experience around it. But we always had a plan and instrumented the system from the beginning to turn it into a lot more, right? I mean, it's like basically it's kind of the first, you know, stage of the rocket, and we always knew that there would be more, right? And so our vision was that if you're at the center of the OR, if you're able to collaborate in this way with the surgeon, well, first you're occupying a very unique real estate, right?
And very much
sort of very much appreciate what's going on in that operating room. And you're working jointly with the surgeon, which means that you're going to be able to document what the surgeon do themselves during those procedures, right? In a way that's unprecedented, very different from what you would do with other types of surgical platforms. And so it's just a wealth of information that you can document and leverage in many, many different ways. And so this is really kind of the second stage, and this is what we've been working on. So the roadmap is a lot about leveraging that sophisticated sensing and embedded edge computing, and turning that into both intraoperative and workflow-related features.
Mm-hmm. So these stages, if I found a document from 10 years ago, you'd find all these stages as part of the business? Because it seems like with the introduction of Maestro, it's obviously coming at a time when and healthcare labor has been an issue for a while, but healthcare labor is becoming a greater issue. The rise of ASCs, ambulatory surgery centers, is there. Of course, AI is making its generational leaps and bounds. I mean,
It's interesting that you said 10 years ago. I think, in a way, what makes it so current and a part of the plan from the beginning is that it was not 10 years ago.
Okay.
It was, you know, 4 to 5 years ago.
Oh, I just assumed, so since you're a med tech,
post-COVID, some of these issues were already... you know, very much spoken about. Staffing issues, for instance, of course, were critical. And also the technology stack that we, you know, integrated from the beginning into the system architecture was sort of becoming there, right? And so it means that it's really AI native, right? I mean, we haven't had to sort of re-engineer the system to put all of that in. And so this is why it was always part of the plan. It's a continuum, if you will. Yeah.
So where are you with commercial availability? Let's talk about where you're selling, and we can get into sort of the strategy of how you're doing that. But what's the current availability of Maestro?
Yeah, so we're at a stage where we have we've received 4 clearances from the FDA to cover the entirety of the commercial product, mm-hmm. including a number of add-on features around our Scopilot feature, which is our first AI control feature, as well as some connectivity features, which are also important for us to scale. We have then completed our limited market release, where we've treated now over 2,000 patients and have deployed about a dozen systems in the field. And so from all of what we've learned, we're now essentially getting ready for a broader commercial deployment. So recruiting a sales force, training it, focusing on a specific market segment, developing our narrative, our return on investment models for it, etc. Yeah.
So as part of your model, you are not selling medical devices. You're not selling the tools that the surgical robotics mm-hmm. device will use. Was that ever a consideration, or did you always just see this as more of a platform or an agnostic surgical robot?
It was never part of the plan to make instruments.
Okay.
I think in a way we're very happy to just work on being compatible with what's in operating rooms. We've had to do a lot of work on maximizing that compatibility. And you know, given our positioning, which is to focus on these low acuity, high volume procedures and settings, and elevating laparoscopy, that we feel that this is where we should be positioned. We don't think we should be going in that direction of making instruments, because the laparoscopy instruments are great.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. So let's talk a bit about I want to understand how you're selling to customers. Sort of what's the hook for them? What do they see Maestro delivering today, now, and then we can talk about where you're headed in the future. But what are your customers? Why are they buying Maestro?
Yeah. So in a sales process, you have, you know, essentially 2 pillars, right? You have a surgical pillar, and mm-hmm. then you have an administrative pillar, right? I mean, arguably in an ASC, those two might somewhat be combined, but you're developing a story that is basically tailored to either a surgeon audience or then like executives, right, and financial leadership. And so from a surgeon standpoint, it is about increased control and autonomy and confidence leading to greater efficiency, right? Reducing variability between those procedures, making them more consistent, being able to do these procedures without the burden of not enough staff or staff that changes all the time, mm-hmm. and doing more of these procedures with fewer staff. Okay. From the administration standpoint, it's about greater OR efficiency, essentially, and monetizing that.
So the efficiency comes from the reliability of the robot being the staff member that's always going to be there
It comes from delivering more surgery procedures with fewer staff.
Mm-hmm. And though you're able to accomplish the more surgical procedures through the efficiencies delivered by AI?
AI delivers even greater efficiency, mm-hmm. but the system, even if in its, let's say, basic configuration, using our system makes procedures more consistent. Hmm. The reason for that is, if you think about laparoscopy is a series of moments where the surgeon is operating, and then moments where the surgeon interrupts himself and waits on something that is being, you know, an instrument exchange or something that is being, you know, coordinated with the person assisting them, and then they sort of go back, and then so it's a series of steps and interruptions. And so when the surgeon is in control of all of these instruments, they in a way don't have to worry about that constant coordination and communication. They can go through all of those steps in a much more controlled way, and they just do it in a more consistent way and in a faster way.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Very instinctual, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Not the other I word. So are you primarily selling, is Maestro equally appealing for traditional clinical hospital settings and ASCs, or do you find yourselves one being a sweet spot over the other?
It's a great question. So in our limited market release, the sites that we had were heterogeneous by design, mm-hmm. right? The purpose of that was to understand what was the market segment that would adopt the system the fastest, and what were the drivers behind that. And so what we found is that we got traction from pretty much any site we were at, but the reasons behind that were different, right? So I'll give you an example. In academia, they were mostly interested in nights and weekend surgery and accelerating laparoscopy training for their surgical residents.
Okay.
In an ASC, they were interested in doing more procedures with fewer resources, mm-hmm. okay, which is sort of what we designed the system for. So it was an interesting learning experience, and so this is why, sort of the back end of the limited market release, we've made a decision to focus on the market segment where our value proposition and our roadmap is going to resonate the most.
Yeah. And you're finding that to be both settings?
We're finding that to be the low acuity, high volume settings, so ASCs and HOPDs, so hospital outpatient departments in like regional settings.
Do you have a competitor?
Yeah, of course. Competitor is, different levels, right?
Yeah.
Hospital administrators and ASC administrators are pressured by surgeons asking for equipment, which can be other robotic platforms or just different
sure.
things. And they have a limited amount of budget that they can spend. So there's always going to be competition for budget. I think other surgical platforms are also going down the ladder in terms of acuity.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And care setting. So of course that is part of the discussion, and then there's always the discussion as to what are the pain points in laparoscopy, right? There's the option of not doing anything and just keeping doing things how you've done them, right? So we need to overcome all of these barriers.
Yeah. Now, as soon as I asked the question, I realized there are others.
Yeah.
Merging of all these systems in the sector. Let's talk a bit about Maestro and how it grows as a system. Someone buys your system. How does your, since you're not selling them instruments, I don't know if you may be selling them another system or two, but what is your way of pulling more revenue or selling more services to that customer?
So we're selling the system as a service, mm-hmm. right? Basically the way we put it is, we're providing that service into the operating room. To some degree, it's like irrespective of how much hardware or disposable elements you provide. It's a service. It's that service of augmenting the surgeon and making them more efficient while the staff can focus on higher value tasks, right? So the way we can monetize these programs more is by selling more service, right? Things that are going to make them even more efficient. And those can be things during the procedure or they can be things, surrounding the procedure, right? So during the procedure, it's, features such as automating the scope movement, for instance, which mm-hmm. is our scope pilot feature. This is something that is going to enhance the workflow efficiencies, right? If the surgeon doesn't have to worry about repositioning the scope, they're going to be even more efficient in how they deliver those surgeries. And then it can be things outside of the surgery. I mean, there's many pain points for the surgeons, right? Or for the entire facility. Writing case notes, managing inventory, managing schedules, optimally deploying your workforce, billing, etc. I mean, it's like there's many, many aspects where you can have an impact with additional features. So we're trying to create a roadmap that is going to maximize that impact in our market segment.
Mm. So let's focus on Scopilot for a second. You've referenced it a few times, and I just want to understand it completely. So. I've tried it, so I think I understand it, but you can explain it for folks. It's very cool. I got to get in the van at SRS last year. You've got the laparoscopic tools in there, and there's the imaging, and the AI is able to basically create the guardrails for the... I'm actually doing your job for you. Why don't you describe Scopilot for folks?
So Scopilot is a feature that is going to keep an instrument, an active instrument of the surgeon, an instrument that is like cutting, dissecting, you know, cauterizing, etc. It's going to keep that instrument centered in the field of view of the laparoscope, mm-hmm. right? And so why is that important? Well, it's important because... laparoscopy becomes risky. One of the reasons why it can be risky is when instruments are outside of the field of view, right? I mean, you're basically working with things that are delivering energy, but you're not seeing them, and you know, mm-hmm. that's when kind of trouble can happen. So keeping those instruments centered is important. It is also what provides the appropriate view for the surgeon to keep working, right? And so this requires constant adjustments, right? Which is typically done by an assistant, as we said. So we're now bringing that ability to the surgeon, but there are parts of the procedure where they want to focus on their surgical technique because they have a fine dissection that they need to do, or like it's a part of the procedure where it's critical for them to just be... handling their active instruments without having to reposition the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Scopilot is used, and it's real-time, on-the-fly machine learning that's done basically on the system and recognizes the tip of an instrument and then servos the arm movement so that the camera stays focused on that instrument.
Interesting. And so... The rest of the AI component, as you referenced in your earlier answers, I mean, you're getting into more of the reporting, more into administrative elements.
Yeah. Setup. I didn't mention setup, but setup is a big pain point, and also something.
What's involved in setup?
So, setting up a surgical platform can be more or less involved. I mean, we've automated quite a bit of it, but. Just basically placing the platform mm-hmm. in a way that is optimal for that indication, for that surgeon, within that room, and based on what the instrument positions are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's something that you can learn over time and automate with AI.
Interesting. Yeah. So adding the services you're going to add in the future, again, we'll sort of build around... You'll have Maestro as an anchor. You'll have the AI sort of branching out, and then providing all of this data collection, all of this reporting. So, where does that? How far does that go in terms of like how many additional software applications or services you're going to be able to provide with Maestro as sort of the center?
I think we view the system as the data hub, mm-hmm. right? And then the features can be deployed either on the system or on a web portal and on an app. Some of it is, kind of freely accessible. Some of it is behind a paywall. But it's basically about an ecosystem that we're, creating to leverage the data that is, sensed in different ways, right? We're going to try and keep it, simple. We're not going to create, tens of different tools. Mm-hmm. So we're going to... make sure that there's a simple interface to access those features, and but it, in terms of the possibilities, it's pretty infinite. Yeah.
So that's it sounds like it's a kind of an operating system for operating rooms. Mm-hmm. Like you're would you be open to, I don't know if other surgical robotic systems or other devices could connect into the platform you're providing and be part of that data collection? I imagine that would be...
Yeah, that or, I mean, the opposite, right? I mean, we can also feed our information into another, you know, operating system or platform, which is, you know, a valid question when you think that, you know, not every single room is equipped with, you know, a platform, or certainly not with the same platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. We've talked about looking at the broader surgical robotics market. How do you see this? We've got quite a herd of companies now, some of which are redundant, some of which I think are novel. How do you see this market sort of playing out in the herd thinning over time? Do you have a sense?
I mean, to me, it's a lot about, you know, creating an offer that is going to be appropriately, you know, designed and marketed for specific use cases and market segments, right? And you know, or types of indications, right? I think there's this consensus that you need certain technical capabilities for certain procedures, and then for others you need, you know, you don't need them, or you need something different, right? So I think it is about creating basically these adjacencies, right? And having the best offer for those specific procedures and settings, right? I mean, that's at least how we position ourselves, and I think that's a vision that is, I mean, something you can execute on, right? I mean, I don't think, as you said, you know, some companies have positionings that might be more directly competitive with each other, but I think the reality is that, you know, the surgical platforms can offer a lot of benefits in a lot of very diverse situations, right? So it's about just creating things that have the right value proposition to address the right pain point.
Very cool. Yeah. Very true. And final question. I want to just, and we started this conversation the day talking to Tim Schmidt at Johnson & Johnson, talking about global footprints. You've got a global footprint as well. You're selling in multiple countries. You run a company that's based in France, but you're building operations here. You have offices nearby here. And I know you've got investors and are rounding up investors worldwide. How have the dynamics of that existence changed over the past year with things that have gone? I don't want to get into politics, but I want to understand how these macroeconomic issues are affecting smaller med tech company like Moon Surgical. If they're not, that's fine. That's an answer too. That's fine.
No, it would be a lie to say that it's not affecting us. No, it has been a bit of a greater challenge, I would say, over the last 12-18 months, just from different standpoints. I think the global uncertainty, whether it's geopolitical or, you know, more kind of on a national level, in Europe and in the US, right? Like, nobody's really better than other. I mean, if you look at France right now, there's nothing to be super proud of. But the global uncertainty is having a massive impact on the appetite of investors for, let's say venture type companies or early stage companies. It's having an impact on the ability of the ability for providers to have a budget for next year.
Yeah,
it's having, I mean, the impact are on multiple levels, right? So for us, yeah, it is, of course, making fundraising more challenging. It's making commercialization more challenging. It's having an impact on our manufacturing strategy, right? So I would say on many, many levels, it's having an impact. Yeah.
Is there a level where it's not having an impact? Because I think we checked all the boxes with that answer.
Not really.
I think that's the end of the conversation. Anne, thanks
Thank
so much
you.
For joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks, a weekly podcast. Thanks again, of course, to our sponsor, Murata, for their support in making this episode possible. Thanks to our two guests, of course, for their time at Device Talks West and for allowing us to share their insights here today. And thanks, of course, to you, our Device Talks community. It's really a pleasure to be bringing you these podcasts. I hope you enjoyed listening to them as much as I enjoy making them and recording them. The editing, not so much. The editing can be a little hard. But it's a real pleasure to bring these podcasts to you. I hope you will join us on December 9th for the Device Talks Tuesday that's being hosted by Managing Editor Kayleen Brown, brought to you by Vantage Medical. You can find out more information about that at devicetalks.com. I hope you'll connect with me on LinkedIn. I hope you'll connect with Chris Newmarker and Kayleen Brown as well. And of course, please do follow Mass Device and Device Talks so you don't miss any future news or insights or opinions or podcasts. And of course, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks podcast network or your individual podcast. If you have a favorite, you can subscribe just to that. So that's it, folks. Thanks again for being part of Device Talks. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, or perhaps have had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Or if you're listening to this many months away from Thanksgiving, you're having a very good day, future you. And I hope future you will reach out to future me and connect on LinkedIn. That'd be a treat. So, all right, folks, thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.